Rabbanim, dear friends, I want to welcome everybody to this very special opportunity to hear our guest speaker, Yonah Ries. I first want to begin by thanking Chabad Lubavitch of St. Louis and Rabbi Landa personally for organizing this entire program. Rabbi Ries is here as part of the Chabad 19th Conference on Talmud and Contemporary Law. He's participated in the program throughout the day. And he was kind enough to agree to stay overnight in order to allow us to have the opportunity to share his presence and his erudition with the community at large. And I want to thank Chabad and Rabbi Landa personally for making that initiative possible and for this evening presentation, which is co-sponsored by Chabad and Young Israel. I want to thank the Young Israel community for that as well. It's a very special opportunity and a special, unique moment to have Rabbi Ries here in St. Louis at this particular juncture as he transitions from his present position as the Dean of Ritz, Rabbi Yitzchok Ochanan Theological Seminary, what I affectionately like to call the yeshiva half of Yeshiva University, and as he assumes the position of the newly appointed Av Beit Din of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, under the leadership and guidance of Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartzschlita, who moves into a position of the Rosh Beit Din. It's really an honor to have Rabbi Ries here in the Midwest, and many of us are members of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, so in that regard, he becomes our Av Beit Din as well. So it's really a pleasure. Rabbi Ries, in addition to receiving his smicha and his ordination in Dayanus Yadin Yadin, from Yeshiva University, also holds a law degree from Yale Law School and has served and has worked in the field of law. He holds is a member of the New York State Bar Association, and so he brings to the field of the Beit Din, the field of the operation of the Beit Din, not only his erudition and scholarship in Torah, but also his knowledge of the field of law and its application. And so it's a very unique composition and very unique convergence of those worlds. I also want to take the opportunity to acknowledge and to thank Rabbi Greenblatt and Rabbi Winter and Rabbi Landa, community Rabbanim, for coming and for making this truly a community event, and for all of you for coming and hearing Rabbi Ries this evening. Chabad Rav.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. It's a tremendous honor for me to speak in the presence of Rabbi Shulman, Rabbi Lander, Rabbi Greenblatt, the other Rabbanim, whose names I'll get to learn as I go along, and to be before you this evening. And I have to say that I find the topic that I was given a little bit daunting, because you never know exactly what everybody really wants to hear from you when you're asked to speak about rabbinic authority and personal autonomy. I wasn't sure if the topic was rabbinic authority and personal autonomy or rabbinic authority versus personal autonomy. But maybe that's part of the discussion. And I want to be careful as I transition into my new position in Chicago with the Chicago Rabbinical Council not to start off by saying anything that would create any undue controversy. So I'll ask you just to begin with that anything that I say, please construe in the best possible way. Please just start off by giving me every possible benefit of any doubt whatsoever. Okay. So it's actually an appropriate week to speak about rabbinic autonomy, because the parsha that we're about to lay is all about challenging rabbinic autonomy. It's about Korach confronting Moshe Rabbeinu and challenging his authority. And we're told that the very beginning of the parasha sets the tone. Vaykach Korach. Korach took himself. What does it mean? He took himself. He's Paleg Korach. That he separated himself from the rest of the community by denying the authority of Moshe Rabbeinu. So the theme, at the very least, of Parshas Korach seems to be that there is such a thing as rabbinic authority. So if there's a contest between rabbinic authority and personal autonomy, we know that rabbinic authority at least gets on the scoreboard. It at least is something that we have to reckon with. And Korach's claim to Moshe was that we don't necessarily need a leader altogether. He says, Ki kol ha'edah kulam kedoshim. The entire nation are all holy. V'socham Hashem. U'madua tisnasu alam Hashem. We know that everybody revolves around the Kadosh Baruch Hu. We all try to be holy, kedoshim to you. Therefore, why should we have leadership altogether? And this really seems to be the theme of the challenges he presented to Moshe Rabbeinu. He brought to Moshe a talis, shekula techelis, that was all made up out of the special color and fabric from which a portion of the tzitzis are supposed to be fashioned. And he says, if I have a talis that's made up of this extremely essential part of the tzitzis, the techelis thread, chayevis b'tzitzis, is it obligated in tzitzis o petura, or is it exempt from tzitzis? And Moshe said, chayevis. It's obligated to have tzitzis, and Korach used that as an opportunity to scoff at Moshe. You have an entire cloak, an entire beged, which doesn't have techelis, a couple of strings of techelis, exempt the entire beged, the entire piece of clothing. If you have clothing which is kulo techelis, all techelis, then why should it need tzitzis altogether? And the Chassam Sofer understood, quotes this in the name of his Rebbe, Nosson Adler, that the point that Korach was trying to make is that if you have a congregation which is completely holy, everybody is holy, then you don't need a leader. And that was the point that he was trying to make in his questioning of Moshe Rabbeinu. If everybody's holy, then you don't really need a leader. I remember that I used to spend my summers in Eretz Yisrael. I had a great uncle and great aunt who settled in Bnei Brak. So I used to sometimes go there during the summer, and there was a shul in Bnei Brak known as the Beis Knesses Hagadol. It was the large Beis Knesses. Well, others that were large, but they just happened to copyright the name before anybody else. So they were called the Beis Knesses Hagadol. And they had a rabbi there. He was a religious Zionistic rabbi, fine rav, by the name of Rabbi Friedman. And I used to enjoy listening to his drushas. So I remember one summer he gave the drusha on Parshas Korach. I mean, that's pretty good. How many people remember like a Shabbos morning drasha altogether? I remember the Shabbos morning drasha from decades ago. And he asked a very simple question. He said, what was wrong with Korach's taina, with his argument? After all, the Parshas Kedoshim starts off with Kedoshim to you. Kedosh ani Hashem Elokeichem. It says you should all be holy. So we know that every single person in Klal Yisrael, among the Jewish people, is holy. So what Korach was saying was memorializing that. Ki kol ha'edah kulam kedoshim. Everybody's holy. So what gives you the right to usurp leadership when everybody in the entire congregation is holy? So Rabbi Friedman pointed out that you could really answer the question very obviously by looking at the grammatical text that appears in the Torah. It doesn't say you're all holy. It says kedoshim to you. You should all become holy. It's not automatic. It's not something which just is without any effort or exertion or leadership. It's something that requires direction. You have to know how to become holy. And that was his mistake. His mistake was in thinking that everybody automatically gets to be holy without there being some sense of leadership, some sense of a direction. How is it, Kedoshim to you? Do you become holy? You become holy by having a proper figure who's able to give instruction to Klal Yisrael. So Rashi, at the beginning of Parshas Korach, makes the following observation. Rashi says that when you have essentially the contrast between the Jewish people and the nations of the world, there's one major element that distinguishes us, and that is as follows. One piece of paper. That is, that when it comes to the other nations of the world, there is like this. There are many different protocols, many different approaches, and many different priests. And they all kind of coexist. Anu ein lanu elo Hashem echad, but we only have one God, v'torah achas, and one Torah, u'mizbeach echad, and one altar, v'kohen gadol echad, and we only have one Kohen gadol. And Moshe Rabbeinu turned to the congregation of Korach and said, v'atem masayim mechami shemish mevakshim kuna gedula gedola, and all of you, the 250 acolytes of Korach, you all want to take the high priesthood? I also would like for everybody to be able to take it, but it doesn't work that way. Because the greatness of the Jewish religion is that we don't have komrim harbe, we don't have utter confusion of everybody running around with their own sect and their own group and their own cult. We have one God, we have one Torah, we have one Mizbeach, and we have one Kohen Gadol. So we do believe there has to be a focused Kedusha. There has to be a centrality of authority in order to maintain a cohesive community. This is what the Ramban emphasizes in Parsha Shoftim, when the Torah says, Lo sasa mikol ha-davar ashir yagidu lecha yamin u'smol. You should not stray from what the rabbis, from what the leaders tell you to the right or to the left. And there's a medrash that says, even if they tell you, al yamin shehu smol, ve'al smol shehu yamin. Even if they tell you that what's right is left, and what's left is right. So you might be driving for a long time before you actually get home. But nonetheless, you're supposed to listen to what they say. And the Ramban explains a little bit more precisely that the meaning of this is that even if you think that what they're saying is right is really left, and what they're saying is left is really right, nonetheless, you have to follow what they say because you have to follow those who have the wisdom, who have acquired the wisdom of the Mesorah, of the traditions that we have been given. Because if every single person goes and they do their own thing, then there's going to be complete dysfunction in the community. That's not the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu intended for us to worship the Torah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu intended for us to be united. Now that being said, does that mean that we have a notion of some sort of papal infallibility? That those who are in charge automatically get a free pass. You could say what's right is left. It's like you can't get a wrong answer on the test. It's a great thing. You see, for me, once I'm in a position of rabbinic authority, this is an easy topic for me because either way I win. Like if rabbinic authority comes out ahead, I could do what I want. If personal autonomy comes out ahead, I could do what I want. So it's kind of easy, right? So the question, you know, is can you just say that at a certain point we ascribe infallibility to our leadership. So that also is something that we don't believe is actually the case. The Torah makes a point in a number of places of noting when Moshe Rabbeinu himself made mistakes. What's the point of recording Moshe Rabbeinu's mistakes? We want to embarrass him? No, it's to send a message that we don't believe that any human being, any rabbinic leader, even Moshe Rabbeinu, is incapable of making mistakes. I have a rabbinic friend I know who has a very clear conscience. He tells me that he has the satisfaction of knowing that he's never done anything wrong or made any mistakes in his rabbinic career. So that's pretty good. How do you achieve that type of result? I don't sleep so easy. Every night I agonize over whatever I've done the previous day. So he said, because he knows that he received a thorough rabbinic training, and he knows once he was ordained as a rabbi, that means that he has a certain amount of judgment. So he doesn't worry about any of his judgments, because he knows automatically they're all fine. So that's not actually the way in which the Torah intended for rabbinic leaders to conduct themselves. Ashrei Adam Mefachei Tamid, a person's always supposed to be nervous, not about the material aspects of life, but about doing the right thing, about complying with the Torah. And notwithstanding the Medrash that I quoted regarding Afilu al Yamin Shu Smol, even though it's right, is left, and so forth, that Medrash also needs some explanation, because there's a Mishnah. There's a Mishnah at the beginning of Maseches Horios that says quite clearly that if the Beis Din HaGadol, the top of the heap, most important, biggest Beis Din, the Sanhedrin, makes a decision and they err in their decision, they make a mistake, and there's a learned person in the community who knows that the Beis Din made a mistake. They said, yeah, it's fine to eat pig. What? Who does it say anyway? You can't eat. Come on. This person knows that the Beis Din made a mistake. That person is held accountable for listening to the Beis Din, and if that person listens to the Beis Din, that person has to bring their own private korban chatas offering. They have to bring their own sin offering. Notwithstanding that most of the people in the congregation, if they choose to rely upon the Beis Din's ruling and they don't know any better, so then they don't have to bring their own private offerings. That's what we call par helim dover shel tzibor. There's one korban that's bought by the Beis Din on behalf of everybody. But if there is an individual who knows better, then that person, in fact, is obligated to follow their own knowledge, and they would have to bring a korban if they listened to the Beis Din's directive in contravention of halacha. So Beis Din doesn't get to say whatever they want. They're not automatically right across the board. There's even a Talmud Yerushalmi that says explicitly, you might think that you should listen to the Beis Din even when they say the Al Yamin Shehu Smol. So Talmud Lomar, that's why we have a pasuk that says, Lo sasum mikol devar shir yagidu lecha yamin u'smol. You listen to them. If they say yamin, then you do yamin. If they say smol, you do smol. But you don't do smol. But now, if you're supposed to do smol and they say yamin, so then you don't listen to them. So we have an internal contradiction, and this is good because most of the time we have internal contradictions. And that's how we arrive at some sort of an understanding of how to live our lives through this type of dialectical tension that we find in our sources, because there's truth to both. There's truth to both. On one level, there is an absolute notion of rabbinic authority, but on another level, an individual who recognizes that the rabbis have made a mistake does have a responsibility to exercise a personal autonomy. And that's how you reconcile these sources. How do we reconcile this type of apparently irresolvable situation? So in the time of the Beis Din HaGadol, the person who felt that the Beis Din had erred would confront the Beis Din. There would be a conversation. There would be a give and a take, and there would be a dialogue. And as a result of the dialogue, the truth would ultimately emerge. Either the Beis Din that was made up of qualified individuals would reverse themselves, or it would turn out that the person who thought that he knew better didn't really know better. But at least it would come to some type of a dialogue in which there would be a vote, and there would be some sort of a coherent system that would enable us to resolve these discrepancies and these potential differences. Now, how does that play out in terms of the modern-day community? We sometimes hear the term Das Torah. Anyone hear that term, Das Torah? So Das Torah is not necessarily one of the classical halakhic categories. If you look in the Rambam, where he states the 13 principles of faith, doesn't necessarily record Das Torah. You have to believe in the Torah. You have to believe that the Torah that we have today is the same Torah that was given in Har Sinai. You have to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have to believe that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is very special, can never be changed one iota. There are various things you have to believe. It doesn't have the term Das Torah. So what exactly is the nature of Das Torah? Is there a compelling concept of Das Torah that binds us? And that leads to an additional question. If there is a compelling notion of Das Torah, and we haven't asked this question yet, but we should definitely pose it, who possesses the Das Torah? You see, in the story of Moshe Rabbeinu, it was kind of easy because you knew that Moshe Rabbeinu was the right leader, since there was nobody else who went up to Har Sinai and received the Torah and gave it over to the people. And when Moshe Rabbeinu was challenged, everybody else got swallowed up by the earth, so it was kind of easy to figure out who was right and who was wrong in this particular battle. But determining who are the rabbinic leaders now is perhaps even a little trickier. So let's look at Das Torah for a moment and what that term means and whether this concept has any validity. So the Gemara does have the term Das Torah. The Gemara has it in sort of an esoteric concept. Gemara wasn't interested in community controversies per se, so just kind of threw out the term innocuously, not knowing what was going to be provoked later on. There's a discussion in the Gemara in Chulin about whether both thighs of an animal are subject to the laws of Gid Anoshev, not eating the sciatic nerve of the animal, and Rabbi Yehuda says, I think it's only one of the thighs, and I think it's the, my das tells me it's the right one. They ask, his das, woohoo! Rabbi Yehuda has das. He has some sort of an idea. Is that Das Torah? Did he have a Das Torah idea, or is it a Das Note? He just thought about it logically. And if you look at the continuation of the Gemara, it appears that what Rabbi Yehuda meant by Das Torah, what the Gemara means, is that did he get it from a pasuk? Did he get it from an actual verse? Did he derive it somehow from the verse Be'av Ko'i Mo? Maybe it's something that can be extrapolated from a pasuk. And that's the sum total, what the Gemara has to say about Das Torah. Then there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that talks about the Kinyanei HaTorah, talks about the various acquisitions of Torah that a person is supposed to make. There are 48 acquisitions. Many have the custom to learn one different acquisition of Torah each day of the Omer, and then the 49th day of the Omer to review all of them. In fact, we did that in our yeshiva this past year. We had a different Rebbe teach about a different Kinyan Torah every single day of the Sefira period. So that was very nice. So one of the Kinyani Torah is Emunas Chachamim. It's Emunas Chachamim. That's an important term. Faith in the Chachamim. Not everybody understands means faith in the Chachamim. Some say that it means the faith of the Chachamim. But Pashup Shat, simple meaning is that one of the Kinyani Torah, one of the acquisitions of Torah, is that there has to be a certain faith in the process of transmitting the Torah through Chachamim. That there is a Mesorah process that really is enunciated at the very beginning of Pirkei Avos, of Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, Vemosel Yoshua, Yoshua is the king, Anshikneses Agdola, that there is a chain of transmission. So what Emunas Chachamim means is that there's an Emuna that you can't just rely upon your own intuition, but in order to extract what it is that the Torah wants from us, how it is that we're supposed to live our lives, one is supposed to follow a certain Mesorah. And that Mesorah existed at the time of the Mishnah through the Tanaim, through the time of the Gemara through Amoraim, then we had Gaonim, we had Rishonim, we had Acharonim. There were certain accepted figures in every single generation who received the torch of Torah from the previous generation. They transmit that Torah to following generations, and at least in terms of acquiring Torah, of knowing what is the right halakha that you're supposed to follow, what are the proper actions that you're supposed to do in terms of knowing what your observance of halakha is supposed to be. So that requires an emunas chachamim, a following of the great sages of every single generation, and not departing from that tradition and saying, well, we're going to take a step back from the traditional sages and we're going to do it ourselves. Because the sages who, you know, got this torch of Torah from prior generations, they're kind of like fuddy-duddy already. They're not in touch with the morals and the mores of the contemporary generation. They're not cool and hip and with it. They don't even have iPads. They don't check their emails. And therefore, we're going to have to go off and create our own rabbinic authority figures, our own rabbinic organizations. That doesn't work. That's really genuinely, I would say, a violation of emunas chachamim. But that only tells us that there is this requirement to listen when it comes to things that are spelled out through a halakhic process. What if you have a great sage who gets up and says, well, I would like to tell you not only how to observe Shabbos and Yontif and Kashrus, but from now on, when you change a tire, this is the way you have to do it. Do you extend Das Torah even to worldly matters that don't seem to necessarily have a clear halakhic context? Or to make it a little bit more confusing, what if it's a political type of policy, you know, to vote for this candidate or that candidate? At what point do you go beyond the contours of halakha? And at what point does the rabbinic authority or this emunas chachamim no longer become operative, if ever? It's interesting because one of my rabbeim, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, told me that when he took his pulpit at the Young Israel of Riverdale, they told him that there was his position as rabbi. And then they would have a president, and the rabbi would decide halakhic decisions, and the president would decide political and policy decisions, and that's the way that they would divide the duties. And he said, that's wonderful, that's fine, I agree 100%, just, you know, one little tweak that I'd like to make. And they said, sure, go ahead, tell us. What he said, I get to decide all halakhic questions, and I get to decide which questions are halakhic. So that, you know, becomes a very perplexing, you know, issue. To what degree do you give authority to these rabbinic figures who are the transmitters of the torch of Mesorah, who have received their traditions from the previous giants of the generations before us? And to what degree do you say, well, we have to be able to exercise a certain amount of personal autonomy? So this comes up in connection with can a rabbi say who you should vote for? Can a rabbi say what position you should take in terms of accepting the legitimacy of the Medina? One can army service. You could think of a host of different areas where this might come up, and I'll differentiate between them in a moment. So it's interesting that it's commonly thought that this idea of Das Torah originated with Agudat Yisrael. And in a context that might not immediately occur to you. You think of Agudat Yisrael in terms of nowadays, the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah and so forth. Aguda existed in Poland before World War II. And the initial public declarations of Das Torah had to do with when Agudat Yisrael actually became a political party. And it was part of the coalition government of Poland. And when there were representatives running for the seats for Agudat Yisrael to be in the Polish parliament, so there were various declarations of Rabbanim saying, you must vote for Agudat Yisrael because it's Das Torah. So this is when the term Das Torah started to be bandied about. So there was, at that point in time, the issue and the question really came to fore. And I don't know that the answer is so simple, so I'm going to kind of say this in as careful a fashion as possible. Rav Soloveitchik, you know, we have here one of the Talmidim Mufakim of Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, Zatzal, the Rosh Yeshiva Sheyeshiva, Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Yochanan for many decades. So he gave a hesped in 1940 for one of the great Gaonim of Europe at the time, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. He passed away. He was the great posek for Lithuania and really for all of European Jewry. Everybody came to Rav Chaim Ozer for their shilas. And the Rav noted that Rav Chaim Ozer became a major authority not only for the standard halakha questions that one might present to any posek, but whenever there was a serious policy question regarding the social policies of Klal Yisrael and the political policies of Klal Yisrael in Europe, he was the person who was always consulted. And the Rav, interestingly enough, here I am talking about a Yeshiva University Torah Umada paradigm, the Rav himself gave some legitimacy to this whole idea of Das Torah in this hesped that he delivered in 1940. It's true, he wasn't yet appointed as a Rosh Yeshiva at YU, so YU can't be held accountable. But nonetheless, the Rav at that time said that Rav Chaim Ozer was a majestic Torah figure because he was like this Kohen Gadol that we just described in the Medrash quoted by Rashi of the Kohen Gadol Echad. How was he like this Kohen Gadol, who is the spiritual leader of the people? He said, because the Kohen Gadol wears two different types of garments. One is the tzitz, that is the head plate that the Kohen Gadol wears across his head, and one is the choshen, where he wears the breastplate that goes across his heart, in addition to the other begadim. He said that the tzitz and the choshen are two seminal begadim because they represent the head and the heart, respectively. You need the head, which we said Rav Chaim Ozer had. He had the brain power to be able to paskin the shilos, but you also need the choshen, you need the heart, to be able to discern what are the spiritual and political needs of the people. Remember, that's what the choshen and mishpat were used for, when they would consult with the Urim and Tumim to make political decisions on behalf of the people. And this was the majesty of the Kohen Gadol, and he said this was the majesty of Rav Chaim Ozer. So in subsequent years, when there would be debates within the modern Orthodox community about the legitimacy of Das Torah, so some people who had a long memory or who, you know, read the books in which these Hespedim were reprinted would point out that the Rav himself seemed to be an early advocate of the idea of Das Torah. And others would say that it can't be, it's a misprint, it was a different Rav Soloveitchik, it can't be that he actually said this. But he really said it. But what is it that the Rav was saying? What the Rav was saying was something which is completely consistent with Torah tradition, and that runs as follows. That ideally, if you are a chacham, if you are a gadol hador, who is sensitive towards the needs of the people and towards the needs of the generation, so how does a person get to be a gadol hador in the first place? Rav Moshe Feinstein, who's undisputably a gadol hador, did not arrive in American shores with a sign that he held up saying, "Hi there, I'm Rav Moshe Feinstein, your new gadol hador." He just went kind of inconspicuously into the Lower East Side or whatever and kind of just shuffled around. And over time, people who conversed with him and asked him questions saw that he had a lot to say and that he was very wise and that they could consult him with questions and they liked the answers. And he writes this in his introduction to the Igros Moshe, to his responsa. He writes, "People just kept on asking me questions. And I gave them answers to the best of my ability. And I was somewhat fortified by the fact that my father told me that someday everybody's going to be asking you their questions." It's good to give some self-esteem to your children when you can. Helps them along. And he said that over time, since everybody just kept on asking me questions, I realized that it was appropriate for me to try to the best of my ability to answer them. It was the same thing with the Rav Chaim Ozer. Nobody appointed him Gadol Ador. It's just that he gave such good, smart, and wise answers that people realized that they could depend upon him. And not only did he have this ability when it came to pure halachic matters, but as somebody who the community as a whole became comfortable with, they became comfortable with his ability to assess what was in the best interests of the tzibur, of the larger congregation, when it came to social and the political issues as well. And they followed his advice with respect to these issues, not because he imposed it upon them, but because it would have been incredibly foolish not to listen to what he said. Since there is a chokhmah, there is an insight that we believe the gedolim, the true gedolim, have, if they're really sensitive to the needs of the people and they really understand all of the political and social issues. So we believe that what comes with that is a certain wisdom and is a certain sense of judgment that is very reliable. And therefore, it's in everybody's interest to choose to listen to that good advice. In fact, there's a very powerful statement in the Gemara in Baba Basra. And many discount it. I'm not sure why, because I think that it's worthy of note, especially since it comes from a Talmudic passage. The Talmudic passage says, "Amar Rav Avdimi, Zemin Chaifa, Miyom." Not our chayfer. The miyom shachara beis hamikdash, from the day that the beis hamikdash was destroyed, nitla nevuah min haneviim and nitla lachachamim. Nevuah, prophecy, was taken away from the neviim, from the prophets, and was given over to the chachamim. Meaning that even though it was taken away from the neviim, min hachachamim lo nitla. Whatever type of prophecy powers the chachamim had was never taken away. So the Ramban on that passage in the Gemara says, what does this mean? It means that even though nitla nevuas haneviim, even though prophecy in the time of the Bible, shehu amara v'chizayon, which is having these visions and these dreams and these prophecies that they're able to see and discern and deliver to the people, even though we don't have that anymore, nevuas hachachamim, what's called the prophecy of the rabbis, shehi b'derech chokhma, which means through their chokhma and their knowledge of Torah, lo nitla, was not taken away, el yodim ha'emes, but rather they're able to discern the truth, beruach ha'kodesh shebekirba, because they have a certain ruach ha'kodesh, there is, we believe, we actually believe this, they actually that have some sort of a divine spirit which is vested within them. And therefore, if they say something, you have, again, not a self-appointed gadol, but somebody that the community trusts because of their chokmas ha-Torah. Somebody like that has really researched an issue and understands an issue and expresses an opinion about an issue. So we believe that there is a certain divine spirit that is associated with that. There is a certain amount of truth to that. Now, that being said, we have to be very, very careful because there are different categories. There is the halakha that has been transmitted through a certain chain, through a certain halakhic process of elucidation, and that halakhic process even enables an individual Talmid who grows in his own understanding to take issue with something that the Beis Din HaGadol itself might decide, subject to, obviously, a give and a take that will take place afterwards. And then there are judgment calls that aren't necessarily based on a halakhic analysis, but are based on a political determination. There's no halakha in Shulchan Aruch that said whether it was appropriate for the Jews to leave Europe before World War II to go to America or to go to Eretz Yisrael. There were certain things that clearly were judgment calls where there isn't necessarily a clearly correct or incorrect answer. I think that we have to be very, very careful that to the degree that there are issues that clearly are based upon the formalities of a halakhic analysis, that what we can't do with these sources is to say that we're somehow going to become more lax in terms of the rigorous halakhic process that is necessary to make halakhic determinations. And one has to be very clear as to whether they're speaking with the tzitz or whether they're speaking with the choshen. But you can't speak with the choshen with the heart and claim that you're speaking with the tzitz with the mind. That if, in fact, something is going to be articulated as a halakhic position with all of the implications of its binding nature that go together with that, then it has to be only with very clearly articulated halakhic exposition. Here's where maybe, who knows, maybe I'm going out a little bit on a limb, but I don't think so, because I have in my corner Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe got very, very upset when, and this is a published tshuva in Rav Moshe and Yoredeach, Chela Gimel, Simen Sadi Aleph, anyone who wants to look it up. Rav Moshe got very upset when people started publishing his psukim, his halakhic answers to questions, as if he was some sort of an oracle, as if it didn't require any kind of halakhic justification, just kind of, Rav Moshe Feinstein said this, ooh, and therefore we have to follow it. But Moshe said the halakhic process is such, and he writes this in his introduction as well, that everyone should have the right to see exactly how I arrived at my answers and how I went through the reasoning process so that people can see whether I'm correct or incorrect, whether I interpreted the sources correctly or incorrectly, and they can come to a discussion and a deliberation regarding the resolution that I offer and the correctness of my answer. And this is an integral part of our tradition and our chain of Torah transmission. And if you lose that, said Rav Moshe, then it's not really halakhic guidance that you're giving. You have to be able to justify your response. So therefore, that, I think, is a sine qua non. When we talk about the rabbinic authority, it's a rabbinic authority that is accompanied by what I would call a rabbinic responsibility. The authority is not automatic. It's not based on papal infallibility of any kind. It's based on exercising a certain responsibility of taking the tradition and the analysis and demonstrating exactly how one has arrived at their decision. That, I think, is indisputable. At the same time, there is this notion of the choshen as well. There is this notion of having to sometimes lead and guide with respect to issues for which there isn't necessarily a clear halakhic analysis. It's a sense. It's a libi omerli. It's a sense. My heart tells me that something is a good policy. It's a good idea to vote this way. It's a good idea to move to this location and so forth. But that's not halakha. And it has to be clearly articulated if it's not based on a... Sometimes someone may want to make a halakhic argument. If you can make a halakhic argument that compellingly proves that everyone halakhically has to vote a certain way, you can make the argument. Then everyone can now analyze the sources, and maybe there is such a thing. But I don't know if it's been done. But maybe there could be such a thing under certain circumstances. But if there isn't such a halakhic argument to be made, so then the only real requirement, I think, that we as Rabbanim have is to make it clear in such a case that it's not a halakhic decision, that it's not a psak per se, that it is a sense of the ruach shebikirbam, it's a sense of the sense and the spirit that is within the Rav, within the rabbinic leadership, and it has to be taken in that vein. And I don't think, here I'm going out on even more of a limb, and you could scream at me if you want, I don't think that has the same binding nature. I don't think it has the same binding nature as a matter of halacha, because in fact it's outside of the realm. That being said, I think that it does have the status of being on a very high level of reliability. But what gets complicated is that it's one thing if you have that coming from Moshe Rabbeinu and he's the clear undisputed leader. It becomes much more complicated and it becomes much more challenging when you have many different conflicting figures who are all voicing Das Torah of this sort. So if you have five different Das Torahs with five different opinions, then you really can't be expected to follow all of them. And you can't be expected necessarily to know which is the ultimate Das Torah. But I would say further, I would say that it's probably the better side of prudence on the part of Rabbanim Bizman Hazeh, leading communities, to provide for a clear halachic guidance with respect to those things that can be argued al pi halacha through the halachic tradition, and to provide with respect to other matters, perhaps the policies that are within the jurisdiction of the Rabbanim in every single particular area. And I think that the Rabbanim in any particular community do have the power to collectively get together and to decide exactly what types of policies they're going to enact based on their feeling of what's in the best interest of their community going forward. I think that this is probably a healthy thing for the communities, but in order for it to work, you really need to be able to establish a consensus. And if you don't have a consensus with respect to these matters, it becomes very dangerous, counterproductive, and probably in the end becomes futile to try to impose a particular perspective if in fact there isn't that sense of consensus or a sense of there being somebody or a group of people that the community trusts enough to be able to reach those types of determinations. But where does the individual fit in this entire analysis? Where does the individual autonomy fit in? And here, I want to just make what I think is a very obvious point, and I'll sort of end speaking about this aspect of the discussion, even though it's really a very large and broad discussion and requires, I'd say, much more time to discuss all of the different facets and elements. But in terms of the individual and the individual autonomy, it's extremely important to note that autonomy exists within our Torah community in the context of it being committed to a Torah way of life. There is no autonomy that is recognized, our tradition anyway, for the person who says that they autonomously want to leave the community or reject halakha or reject the Torah. Fundamentally, that really was the message of Kafal Amas Hahar Kigigis. When the Torah was given, why was it given with a large vat, a tub, being held over everybody's head, where the Medrash says, "The Kabbal Mutav, you accept the Torah, wonderful. Vimlav Sham Tehek Vuraschem, and if not, then this is the end of you." So everyone always asks the question, why did Hashem have to do that? After all, everyone said, Naseh V'nishma. We're willing to accept everything voluntarily. And there are lots and lots of different answers that are given. I think the answer is just to underscore a very fundamental point. Of course, we all love the Torah and we all follow the Torah voluntarily. And of course, it was a voluntary Kabbalah of the Torah, fundamentally. But there's an important message over here, which is that even our voluntariness in life is within the purview and it is within the context of considering ourselves inextricably bound to a Torah way of life, and not only that, but to a Torah system of how we regulate our decision-making processes within halakha in accordance with our time-honored traditions. And that is non-negotiable. But within that non-negotiability, why would anyone feel a need to be restricted in any way? The Kafal Am Sahar Kigigis was accompanied by Akimu Vekiblu, was accompanied by Anasev and Ishma. It's always accompanied by a sense of a voluntary acceptance of Torah, and that voluntary acceptance also was an empowering voluntary acceptance because there are so many different pathways to Torah. There are so many different pathways to individual realization of self-fulfillment in the observance of Torah. But within Torah, some people who became great mikubalim, some people who became great Baalei Machshava, philosophers, others who became Baalei Halakha, who became great halakhic figures, others who became great darshanim, other within the way in which a person can live their life. Living Torah, you could be an artist, you could be a doctor, you could be a lawyer, you could be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, in so many different ways. We don't say to every single person, you must be a this, you must be a that, you must serve a Kadosh Baruch Hu in this particular manner. There is such a diversification within our own Torah world of how a person can become, number one, a Torah leader, and how a person can become a Torah individual and bring out every single facet and every talent and every skill that resides within them in the service of living a Torah life. So I never fully understand why there should be a feeling of a lack of personal autonomy. If the question is, do you have the personal autonomy to leave the faith? So of course, you don't have the person. You have the Bechiva Chavshis, but it's not a good idea. Because the Torah says, V'charta b'chayim, you're better off keeping Torah than straying from Torah. It's not a good idea. So that sense of individual autonomy, I think everybody has. But it's even more than that. The Gemara in Yuma says that there were three different crowns that were given to the Jewish people. There was the Keser Melucha, there was the Keser Kehuna, and there was the Keser Torah. The crown of kingship, the crown of priesthood, and the crown of Torah. Crown of kingship, David and Mal came along and took that. Crown of priesthood, Aaron and Cohen came along and he got that. But the crown of Torah, Dayan Munachu, still sitting there. Everybody who wants to take it can come along and they can take it. What that means is that there's a tremendous sense of empowerment that's given to every single person to become part of this rabbinic authority, to become part of the unfolding of the tradition of halacha. A person goes to yeshiva, a person becomes a talmid chacham, a person becomes a master in halacha, a person can actually participate in the give and take with the giants of the generation, and every single person has the ability to become amongst the giants of the generation in terms of being able to elucidate halacha. There is no fundamental contest or war or tension between the rabbis over here and the individuals over here. The individuals get to be the rabbis. That's the beauty of the Jewish tradition. But it's the same idea as what Moshe Rabbeinu essentially needed to explain to Korach. It's not kula kikol hayda kulam kedoshim, but rather it's kedoshim to you. It's not an automatic plane where every single person can go off and disagree and do their own thing, but rather it's that everybody has the ability of kedoshim to you. Every single person has the ability to become someone who fulfills their potential in terms of the holiness that is available to each and every single Jew to be able to achieve. And the more in which a person realizes that potential, so the more that they have a voice and the more that they can become a part of being one of the decision makers and one of the voices in the process of figuring out how to determine Torah decisions properly. There's a pasuk in Parshas Shoftim. It says, "Lo sakim l'chom atzeva asher sanei Hashem malokecha." You're not allowed to build an altar of one stone because the Kaddish Baruch Hu hates it. So Rashi comments that the Kaddish Baruch Hu didn't always hate one stone. There was a time that the Kaddish Baruch Hu liked one stone very much, and that was in the days of the Yovos, that this was Ahuv, something that was beloved, Ahuva b'mei Avos, and now became Sinua. Now it became hated before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So why is it that the altar of one stone was beloved in the days of the Avos, of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and then later became hated, detested by HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So, simple answer Rashi gives is that, it was used for Avodah Zarah purposes. But the truth is there were other things that we did in worship that were done by worshippers of Avodah Zarah as well, such as bringing Korbanos all together, or bringing a sacrifice on an altar of many stones. So what was specifically wrong with the altar of one stone? And I think that the answer is, and this is, I think, an encouraging one, when we talk about the importance of personal autonomy in the Jewish tradition, I think the answer is that in the days of the Avos, there really was only one approach towards the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because there was only one real giant, there was only one real Torah personality in each generation. You had Avram, then you had Yitzchak, and then you had Yaakov. So they had to bring an altar of only one stone. In fact, it's the famous story of Yaakov. It says, "V'ikach me'avnei amakom," he took from many stones. Then it says that he took from the Yasim Evan, that he took one stone, Vayasim Osa Matseva, Vaykach Evan, that he took only one stone and made it into a Matseva. So the question that Rashi asks is, which is it? Is it Vaykach Me Avnei Amakom, he took from many stones, so Vaykach Asa Evan, but he took one stone, Vayasim Erashosa, Vayasim Osa Matseva, and then he made that into a Matseva. So Rashi explains that the stones, the Medrash says, they were fighting with each other. Each stone wanted to be under his head, so they all got what they wanted and they were combined into one stone. They only have to be combined into one stone. I think that there is a symbolism there. And the symbolism is that in the days of Yaakov, everything was monolithic. There was only one way, Yaakov's way of serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And what happened after Yaakov? Yaakov had 12 sons. And we're told that each one received a different type of a bracha. Each one had their own individual strengths, their own special way of serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Yehuda would be the leaders in terms of the monarchy. Levi would be the spiritual head. Shimon would go out and they would be teachers. Zebulun would be business people. You would have Naphtali that would go about and they were incredibly fast and they were able to do things with tremendous zeal and alacrity. And every single one had their own special strength. So at that point in time, the Matseva became Sinua. The idea of just having one stone was no longer appropriate. We do believe in having many stones at this point in time. At this point in time, there are many different ways in which we can legitimately serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu within the Torah tradition. And it's possible as well that even with respect to some of the issues that are confronting the community today, there might be an elu v'elu. There might be a legitimacy towards a part of the population taking a position in which they're not interested in pursuing secular studies, and a part of the population that has a mesorah that this is appropriate for them. Maybe legitimacy to part of the population that believes that you don't say Hallel on Yom HaAtzmaut, and part of the population that does say Hallel on Yom HaAtzmaut. There might be a legitimacy to having a part of the population that votes Republican and part of the population that votes Democrat. There might be a legitimacy to part of the population that is within the Haredi community and part that's within the modern Orthodox community. There can be a legitimacy to multiple perspectives and traditions, even within Torah Judaism. But what we have to be careful about is that we need to make sure that every single approach is firmly grounded in a tradition that can be traced back to Har Sinai, that is consistent with approaches of indisputable gedolim of the previous generations who have transmitted to their students of this generation, and that we are not in any way veering off from the path and creating new and illegitimate forms of observing the religion that are not in accordance with all of these essential protocols and systems that we have set up throughout all of the generations. So in conclusion, it's really not such a simple issue, and it's not such a simple discussion, but at the end, there is no contest where somebody has to be knocked out. Is it rabbinic autonomy, rabbinic authority versus personal autonomy? I would say that I would just change the words a little bit. What we have in our tradition is rabbinic responsibility that has to be exercised by the rabbanim in maintaining the respect for previous traditions, and also maintaining a clearly delineated distinction between decisions that are halakhic in nature that need to be provided with absolute reasoning, and decisions that are policy decisions that need to be articulated as such the community can understand that's the nature of it, and that these are not halakhic decisions if they don't come with halakhic reasoning. And there needs to be personal responsibility as well. Personal responsibility in having respect for maintaining a Torah lifestyle and for constricting one's own passions accordingly, so that there is a reverence for the system of Torah law that we have always followed throughout the generations. But at the same time, also a personal responsibility for each person to realize their potential to the fullest in terms of their acquisition of Torah, and to exercise their particular talents and skills and inclinations to the fullest, to be a full-fledged participant in the Torah community. Every single person has to say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, that the universe was created only for me. And that doesn't mean that you run off and say that I'm going to do my own thing and don't care about rabbinic tradition, but it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put, of course, every single individual in this world for a purpose, and that we're not supposed to be simple automatons or nomads who don't have minds and personalities of our own. Every single person, of course, has to be able to realize their individuality to the fullest degree within the prism and within the community of Torah and Torah ideals and Torah values to which we all belong. And I pray that we should all be able to achieve a full realization of what we say at the end of Shmona Esrei every single day, three times a day, that Yiratzim, that V'sein Chokeinu B'sorasecha, that Kadosh Baruch Hu should enable all of us to be able to realize to the fullest our each individual chelek, our each individual portion in the unfolding of the Torah with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world and created each and every one of us. Thank you very much. Oh, sure, sure. Absolutely.
First of all, I just wanted to, Rav Soloveitchik once said, I heard this, that when the Rambam says, you were talking about the halakhic process, when the Rambam says Yira Li, it's more powerful than when the Rambam brings a raya. Because when he says Yira Li, everything about him, the fiber of his being, is giving out this psak based on his collective feeling and his collective idea, and that, he says, supersedes any one raya that you can bring from a soul.
Except that the difference is that when the Rambam says yearly, and I accept what you said, but when the Rambam says yearly, it follows an extensive halakhic analysis and discussion of all of the sources or all of the halakhic points that relate to a particular inyan, to a particular subject. And after the Rambam has summarized all of the different points, and it's clear that he has exhausted the halakhic spectrum, so then the Rambam says, and there's still some ambiguity, but based on this thorough analysis, I'm able to now venture an opinion. But if somebody steps up, and without acknowledging any of the background, or feeling a need to bring in any of the background, just says yearly, so that's much less powerful, and it's not something that the Rambam ever did. Yeah.
Take a few moments. Reese has offered to spend a few moments with questions if there are.
Any other questions? Okay. Good. Everything's been resolved. Wonderful.
Then I will take the opportunity on behalf of Rabbi Landa and the Majinda, Rabbi Winter, myself, and the community, Rabbi Shafter, and to acknowledge and to thank Rabbi Reese for coming, for sharing, for enlightening, and I, for one, am going to have a lot of trouble sleeping tonight because so much to think about and consider. So thank you very much for everything.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Okay.